Thank you so much. I am Clay D, and I am an alcoholic. By both the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as it's explained in the big book, I had my last drink on March 27th, 1974. And, you know, I've done this before, and by the grace of God, I've been in the program a few 24 hours, and Todd and I are talking. You'd think I wouldn't be nervous, but I'm scared to death. I always am. And I appreciate you not letting me whine. I forgot. I almost thought this was Whiners Anonymous, not Alcoholics Anonymous. I appreciate the rain going away. It seems like it's following me everywhere. And I appreciate Todd filling in last night and allowing me to do it tonight. Because we did finally get here, weather permitting, and I just want to thank you all so much. I want to thank Joan for inviting me, and really appreciate your story this morning, and you just touched my heart so much, and I couldn't agree more about if you've got an alcoholic in the family, you don't have a sick person in the family, you have a sick family. And I'm very blessed that my family is in recovery and has been all these years. And my story discloses in a general way what I used to be like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. And I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon, and my mom and dad were poor. I didn't know that until I joined the Navy a lot of years later. Every kid on my block was poor. So we were all the same. My dad was a chronic alcoholic. He was the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde that the big book talks about. On one hand, on the other hand, he was the man I loved, respected, admired more than any other man in my life. He's a guy that taught me how to hunt, how to fish, how to play baseball, talked to me openly and honestly about girls when I got old enough to be interested in that action. He was more than a dad, he was my good friend. But he was, you know, if you're raised in an alcoholic home, though, from the day you can remember, you don't learn how to cope, you don't learn how to emote, you learn how to survive. And I became a survivor because this guy who's my hero on one hand was the guy that would come in unexpected, unannounced, cursing, and he was a batterer. He hit my mom, and I'd be laying in there as a little boy with head under the pillow, hearing the flesh hitting flesh, the cursing, the crying, and all that insanity that goes on in an alcoholic home, you know, and then get up and go to school the next day as if nothing happened. And that was kind of my backdrop. My mom and dad were also not very spiritually motivated. They made agnostic look spiritual. The only time I heard my mom and dad talk about God was very derogatory, and any time they talked about people who believed in God, it was even more derogatory. So that's kind of the backdrop with which I grew up in. Oregon is a lot like Texas, I guess a lot like anywhere, but it seemed to me growing up it had this Paul Bunyan lumberjack mentality, a two-fisted drinker where men are men and all that kind of stuff. And you know, I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind. From the day I took my first drink, which was a teenager, I had no illusions of doing anything that even remotely resembled social drinking. To this day, I don't understand it. I'm not wired the way social drinkers are, you know. They drive me nuts. Friend of ours, we went over to a couple's house, and my wife is a non-alcoholic in Al-Anon, and this dear friend of mine's wife is a non-alcoholic, and she had a glass of wine, a little bitty glass on top of it, which is enough to make you sick right there. And then she only drank a little bit of it. And then when she was done, she put Saran wrap on the top of it and put it in the refrigerator. Now, I've experienced a lot of insanity in my life, but nothing to that degree. So what I'm convinced is I'm not wired like normal people. Nor do I want to be, I don't think. I heard a friend tell me one time that normal was a dial on a washing machine. I don't know. But I remember my first drink as clearly as I'm standing here tonight. You know, I drank as much as I could drink. I puked and I passed out. When I came to, the two guys that I got drunk with, I was a sophomore in high school, were laughing and telling me how cool I was, and all I knew was, wow, Ain't I cool? I got to do some more of this action. So the next weekend we did. In my sophomore in high school, I became a periodic. Now, they talk about people that cross that line into alcoholism. Hell, I was already 3 feet on the other side of it, didn't even know it was behind me. I just loved alcohol. I loved drunkenness. I loved everything about it. I must have, because that's the only state I wanted to be in. By the time I was a junior in high school, I was I'd gotten a phony ID card that said I was 21, and I was a school pusher for beer and wine, you know. And the way that I fed my alcoholic habit in high school was that I'd go out and buy a case of beer for one of my buddies, keep a six-pack, and just do that deal three or four times, and drink in the style that I'd gotten accustomed to. Because of baseball, and only because of baseball, I somehow miraculously made it out of high school and didn't end up in the reformatory or something like that. But I graduated from high school in 1965 and immediately went in the United States Navy. Now, when I joined the United States Navy in the world of alcoholic drinking, it was, and all the sneaking and lying and cheating you had to do as a teenager, you know, to do that stuff, it was like going from the minors to the majors in the world of drinking. Everything that I'd been sneaking around about had become sanctioned. It wasn't socially accepted. You drank, puked, got drunk. It was socially expected, and I loved it. I loved every bit of it. You know, as long as you could drink as much as you could drink every night, puke, pass out, get up, and get that ship underway the next day, you were a real man. You were a sailor. And God, I loved that. I loved that image. I loved all that stuff about it. I loved not having to deal with Clay D, because I had this huge hole inside of me. The best description I've ever heard of myself is an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. You know? I was a legend in my own mind and scared to death you were going to find out that I wasn't, you know. And I was a high achiever, you know. That's the way that I hid. As long as I could accomplish, especially in the service, I would be okay. I had been dating this girl in high school before I joined the Navy. We didn't like each other and broke up, but I got lonely, you know, and I wrote her a letter. You know, and so she wrote me back. I wrote her another letter, she wrote me back. And what happened was that she asked me to her senior prom. So I'd gotten stationed on this ship. I'm 18 years old. I'm homeported in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Horrible place to be. And I really believed that. If I could get off this rock, everything would be okay, you know. But anyway, I go home to go to her senior prom, got drunk, got married instead. It made all the sense in the world. She was still in high school. The main reason I got married, and I believe this with my whole heart, is we went and talked to her dad, and he said, absolutely not. We went to her mother and talked to her. She said, absolutely not. Went to my dad, and he said, no. Went to my mom. She said, no. So we did. One thing that I'm assured of however else I'm wired, I've got this little anti-authority thing going on. You tell me no, that pushes a button that I don't understand. I just know it gets engaged, and I'm going to act on it. So we got married. I went over overseas. Vietnam was going on, so I went on this Southeast Asia tour. She was 2 months pregnant. I went on a 9-month tour. And when I went over to Southeast Asia, when I went overseas, if going from high school as an alcoholic into the Navy was going from the minors to the majors in the world of drinking, going overseas was like going to the World Series. Man, every seedy, smutty, derogatory thing I could get involved in, I did. I thought I'd died and gone to alcoholic heaven. And everybody else was doing it. You know, it was okay. And when I came home, however, you got to figure, this teenage wife, now with his 7-month-old son, the first time that I'd seen him, she had coped the only way she knew how by joining the Mormon church. And I didn't know a lot about Mormons at all, and please don't ever misunderstand. I have learned a lot about Mormons, and they have such fine family values, and it's just a wonderful religion. But when you're the alcoholic of my type, in 1967, and a cool sailor on top of it, who smoked, drank, and did everything else that alcoholic sailors did, they didn't send the missionaries over to my house every night. They were there every night at 5 o'clock. They sent the elders. These are guys that were like my father's age. And they felt like the boys on the bikes weren't going to do it, so they sent the big guys. They'd sit there and tell me what they thought I ought to do, and I'd sit there and tell them what I thought they ought to do. And It didn't work out real well. Needless to say, that marriage didn't work out real well, and in a drunken stupor, I kicked her and that baby out of my life. I had, during this time, transferred off the ship and applied because, you know, I am a legend in my own mind, and because I am exceptionally good at everything I do, at least that's how I hid, I put in for the intelligence community. You know, it's this elitist group. Well, go figure, I was selected, you know. And the scary part of this thing is I blacked out from the day I first, you know, when I was drinking, I blacked out from the first day I ever drank. You know, and it wasn't where, you know, I gauged my drunk fine. You know, well, I must have had a great drunk last night. I can't remember where I parked the car. Well, it wasn't a matter of losing parts of time in a night. Now I was losing a couple of days at a whack, and, you know, and truly not knowing what I'd done, just knowing that I was performing somewhere, doing something. But, and so this is a guy who's now an intelligence analyst for the United States Navy. That's a scary proposition. Guy had security clearances that most people don't even know exist, you know, and, gee, I don't know. I met my blue-eyed, blonde-haired beauty sitting up here, my wife, during this period of time. And she was a good person, you know. She was young, I don't know, 20, 21, and I wasn't around good people. I didn't run around good people. I didn't want to be around good people because what they did is they highlighted my shame, my personal degradation. So I hung out with cats like me, and the Navy's full of them. So all of a sudden, I meet this really nice woman, and I made such an impression on her. We were at a dance spot in Waikiki, and she lived over there. I made such a good impression on her. I asked her, I said, you know, the joint was closing. I said, would it be okay if I take you to breakfast? That's just what, you know, you did when you're trying to score. And so she was so enamored with me that she, not exactly like the description you did, but she goes over, she says, well, let me have your driver's license, is the way I remember it. And so I want to make sure you are who you say you are. That was the first clue. So she takes it over, shows picture to her girlfriends, her roommates, and says, now, if I'm not home in an hour, call the police. And that's the way we started off our courtship. Now, I had had a traffic accident where I totaled my car, spent several months up in Tripler Army Hospital, all alcohol-related, but covered up by the Navy. You know, my whole medical record is that thick from this accident. So it's every page stamped not due to misconduct in the line of duty. I don't know what kind of duty I was in line of, but I was having fun doing it, I think. But anyway, because of that, I didn't have a car. And so I somehow managed to get down. My wife lived in Waikiki at the time, and I lived out by in Aiea, Hawaii, out by Pearl Harbor Naval Station. And I'd go down. We'd go out, you know, and she never saw the alcoholic side of me. I was, you know, she's a good girl. We'd go out, have a few drinks, you know, all the young couples did. And then I'd hightail it and do my action with my cronies until the light of the silvery moon, you know, afterwards. Because she was a good girl, so she'd go home. The trouble was the bars closed at 2 in the morning in those days, and the buses quit running at midnight. So that's a heck of a dilemma. But this is 1969, and it was a kinder, gentler, more trusting world in those days. So people didn't have car alarms. They didn't take their keys out of their cars hardly at all. And so I just walk along the streets of Waikiki until I found a car that had keys in it, and I borrow it. You know, I'd drive over Red Hill there to where I lived and park it in the grocery store parking lot across the street from my apartment. And I'll never forget, you know, there's this desensitization process that we alcoholics go through. The first time I did it, I was pretty inebriated, but man, by the time I'm halfway home, I'm holding onto that wheel, looking in the rearview mirror for that blue light every 2 minutes, and I'm sober before I'm halfway home, paranoid I'm going to get stopped for borrowing this car. Then second time I do it, you know, I glance up once in a while. Third time I do it, I got the radio on, the window down, and I'm cool, doing 80 miles an hour over Red Hill. Now you got to stop and remember, I'm an intelligence analyst for the United States Navy. My fingerprints are recorded everywhere in the world, and I never wiped nothing. I just left. I never hurt anything. I just wanted to ride home. It's made all the sense in the world. That's just kind of the drunk I was. You know, I heard a story once that kind of describes my wife's and I relationship during what I pray to God to be the last 4 years of my drinking when we were married. And that's this guy had gone out on a toot, and his wife, potential Al-Anon she is standing there at the window with her nose pressed to the window pane, waiting for her hero to come home, and he comes staggering home, and she opens the door and says, "Where have you been?" He said, "Oh, I've just been down at the bar. I've just been having a few drinks." And she said, "Well, where's the new sport coat I bought you for your birthday?" "I must have left it at the bar." She said, "Well, I paid perfectly good money for that coat. I want it back. Now, what bar were you in?" He said, "Oh, I know that it had a green door, a red rug, and a gold commode." And she said, he passes out. But she's determined. She's going to go ahead and get this coat back. She starts calling every bar in town. "Bartender, do you have a green door?" "No, ma'am." "Bartender, do you have a green door?" "No, ma'am." Gets about halfway down. "Bartender, do you have a green door?" "Yes, yes, we do." "So by chance, do you have a red rug?" "Yes, ma'am, we do." She says, "Bartender, I know how foolish this must sound, but is there any chance you have a gold commode in your establishment?" Bartender cupped the phone and said, "Eddie, get over here. I got a lead on the guy that took a leak in your saxophone." You know, I, borrowing a few cars, taking a leak in saxophone, you know, I wasn't a batterer. I wasn't all those things my dad was. I was just a drunk. You know, and my wife thought I was the most dedicated sailor in the United States Navy because my work hours were 0800 to 4:30, 16:30 in the afternoon. But there was a bar where we lived called Buddy's Lounge that opened. It was a Navy stag bar, and it opened up at 6 o'clock in the morning for sick call. Well, I was sick every morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, and so I'd stop there. I'd get up 5:30, no matter what time, I'd come in at 5:30, change clothes, get my uniform, then head to Buddy's, be the first one there. And I'd drink until 7:45, drive like crazy to St. Pat Cleve headquarters, and that's the way I'd start my day. I did that every single day for the last 3 years of my drinking. I used to go over to the club on base and drink lunch every day with my cronies, shoot shuffleboard. We never ate. And then I'd stop off at happy hour. And sometimes I'd go home, sometimes I wouldn't. I had this thing that would happen. I never knew when or how it would happen. I had perfectly every good intention in the world, but I call it I don't care button. My I don't care button could get engaged, and I'd show up for work somehow every day because that was the one good thing I had left going for me at this time, but I wouldn't go home for 2 or 3 days, you know. And then one day I took off from work in the middle of the day, and my I don't care button got engaged, you know, and I'm in and out of these blackouts all the time. Anyway, 3 days later, I hadn't showed up in the Navy either. And this guy I worked for, I worked in the Air Intelligence Division, this guy I worked for, got a hold of me, I think, through my wife by calling some of the joints that I hung out in. And it was another Navy stag bar in Pearl City, Hawaii, and there was this real... Yeah, I don't know where you drank, but where I drank, there's always a crass barmaid, you know? And this gal, she was just real crass. And she you know, she answered the phone and said, "Hey, Clay, I got your boss on the phone, and boy, is he ticked. Ha, 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 ha." And she starts walking that phone down to me, you know? And all the eyes in the bar, all my other heroes are looking at me. Well, you got to be cool, right? So I'm sitting there, and I just go into automatic, and I grab that phone, and I told him what he could do with Think Back headquarters, the intelligence division, for that matter, the entire United States Navy, and I hung up. Everybody at work, everybody in the bar, "Oh, yeah, Clay, oh, what a hero, give him one on me." I had to go to work the next day. For the first time in my life, I don't know about you, but I know about me, no matter how bizarre, how stupid, how ridiculous it was to all of you, somehow in this alcoholic mind, I could come up with some irrational reason that made sense to me of why I did what I did, whatever that was. This was the first time in my life I could not come up in my mind with an irrational reason of why I did what I did that made any sense to me. And so I go into work that day, and the guy won't even talk to me. He says, "Go see the commander." And I go in and see the commander, shuts the door. And there's my service record with a report shit on it recommending court-martial. And this man started chewing. And boy, he knew how to do it. He was an artist. He started chewing up one side of me and then down the other and then back home again. And the whole time he's a-chewing, my mind's a-racing. God, Clay, there's got to be something you can give this guy, some ridiculous answer anyway. I couldn't even come up with a ridiculous answer. And he's a-chewing, and my mind's a-spin. Finally, he says, Clay, is there any chance, he didn't call me Clay, whatever my rank was, Deerdorf, he says, is there any chance at all that you might be alcoholic? Gosh, I went into automatic. My tears... dreaming down it. Oh my God, Commander, I'm so glad the secret's finally out. All I knew, if this boy wanted me to be an alcoholic, I was going to be the best alcoholic showed up on his course. And it worked. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. He says, if you'll go over on the Naval Station, Pearl Harbor Naval Station, see this retired Chief Petty Officer named Shep, and do every single thing that that man tells you to do, I'll hold on to this court-martial recommendation right here in my pending box. So I did. I went over there, and I walked into Shep's office. And, he's a father figure, my sponsor. He's been the only sponsor, primary sponsor I've ever had, still alive. And anyway, he looks at me and knows that he's got to stop the thing. I think I'm 25, 26 years old. He's 40-something maybe. He's got bright red hair, and he says, well, youngster, and that ticked me off immediately, you know. He says, well, youngster, he says, you think you might be a little sick and tired of being sick and tired? And I'm sitting there thinking, what is this old fart talking about, you know? But I'm cool. And I said, if you want me to be sick and tired, oh, yeah, I'm the sickest guy you've seen and the tiredest person that's ever walked through your door. And I can't imagine, well, yeah, I can, what he thought. But he went through the drill. You know, you're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days, and you're going to do this, you're going to do that, and if you don't, I'm going to call this commander, yada, 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 yada. And so I'm sitting here, you know, smiling and nodding, thinking to myself. And so I'll never forget, the very first meeting I ever went to is a guy named Ken, who I used to shoot shuffleboard with and drink lunches with. He's telling me, I thought Linda had set me up. I swear to God, I thought, I just don't believe this. She set this up. But I'll never forget, you know, I liked everything that I saw. I tried not to listen to too much, but it all stuck, you know. When you're different and you're cool, you know, I'd hear your stories and say, wow, so if I ever get that bad, then I'd have to join you guys too. You know, total denial of all the garbage I'd been doing. And I'll never forget, I got they used to give out a red chip, called it the danger chip, and I was the youngest guy at every meeting I went to. I mean, that was June of 1973. In June of 1973, there weren't a lot of 20-year-olds at meetings. That's why I love to see what's happened over the years. I just love it. But, I mean, I was the youngest guy by 10, 15 years at every single meeting I went to. And it also wasn't real popular to be a hot-running sailor and going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. So, you know, I had all this stuff going on. And so I got this danger chip at the young people's meeting. I was the only young person there. And I stood up, and I said, well, I just want to thank you all so much. And if I ever get as bad as you all did, then I know exactly where to come back because you've shown me the light. Can you imagine? And no... needless to say, I didn't stay sober very much longer. I white knuckled it until January of 1974, and in fact, January 6th was the day I relapsed. Didn't plan it; I just did it. Went straight to this bar, had no intention of going to it, and walked in and said. The gal there, you know, the Navy Stag Bar, Buddy's Lounge, says, hey, Clay, I haven't seen you in a while. Yeah, well, I've been out to sea. I lied like crazy. So I drank, took that bottle and glass, went to a booth, and it took me an hour and 32 minutes to drink that beer. Now, I don't know to this day for sure why I know that. I just know that. I kept looking at my watch, taking a sip, looking at my watch, taking a sip. And I believe in my heart what happened was one of the things that you said, in addition to all the other things that stuck, was, you know, it's not the 10th or 20th or 6th drink that gets you drunk. It's the very first sip of the very first drink. And I was sitting there, I think, taking an hour and 32 minutes sipping that beer because I was waiting to go crazy and punch somebody or pinch a waitress or do something like I typically did. And when that didn't happen, the thought hit me, man, I've been here an hour and a half. And I swallowed that last swallow, put it up on the bar, and she asked me, do you want another? My exact words were, no thanks, I don't need it. Got in my car, went home, kicked my wife out so I could drink in the style that I'd gotten accustomed to before. Because I knew she wouldn't understand that I could drink normally again. You have to understand what my normal was. And I didn't want to go through the yada, yada, yada and all that stuff, so, you know. But then I got lonely. She left, went back to St. Louis, and I'm there in Hawaii, and she took the dog. She promised she wouldn't take the dog. She took the dog. And in Hawaii, they have a quarantine session. So when she... The reason she came back is that I finally, she had been wanting me to go see a psychiatrist. Well, I had this stigma about, you know, how could a legend in his own mind be insane, you know? And so, the reason she came back is I told her, I said, look, I'll go see a psychiatrist. You see, it was okay finally for me to be crazy rather than alcoholic. And so she came back, we put the dog in 4 months quarantine, I just stayed drunk. I can't tell you, I honestly can't tell you anything that happened in the month of February, March of 1974. Just very little bits and pieces. I showed up at work on time because I didn't get court-martialed or whatever, but I know it was right around the corner. I was sitting out at this park in Pearl City on March 27th and drinking this jug of wine. I'm in my whites, the Pride of the Pacific Fleet. And there's that part in chapter 11 where it says, you know, we will know loneliness such as few do. We will be at that jumping off point. The only friends I had were terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. You know, I had fully gotten to that point where I could not imagine living life with alcohol for another minute in a horrible, horrible terror and fear that there's no way that this guy could get and stay sober. And that's where I was. So I sat there and figured out how I was going to kill myself. And I was as serious as a heart attack. I was as serious as I'm standing here looking at you out right now. And the way I was going to do it, I had this old beat-up Volkswagen Beetle. I was going to get in that car, and I was going to go up on the H1 freeway and drive it as fast as I could get that thing to go and run into a cement piling. That way Linda and my daughter, by the way, had just been born the year before that. She just celebrated her first birthday on March 20th of that year. And so... And I choose to call it the miracle and the blessing of a blackout. I got up, to this day, the last thing I remember is I'm walking towards that old blue beetle. The next conscious thing I'm remembering and know, I'm sitting in my living room, Linda's on her knees in front of me, I'm sitting in my chair in my living room saying, is it okay if I call Ken? I couldn't even talk, I just nodded my head. She did, he came over, and... That started what I pray to be a lifelong journey for the rest of this man's life in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came back in, I was warmly welcomed in a way that I didn't know was humanly possible. He gave me half cups of coffee. I had to laugh at that. I didn't have the shakes. I had the leaps. I was coming out of my skin. Wrong side out, you know? And I was spilling half cups, you know? But Shep in those days assigned platoons to a newcomer, you know? So I had this group of 1 to 2 year guys that followed me everywhere. And one day I went to him and I said, you know, I said, Shep, I said, I don't know if I can do this for a whole day. I don't know that I can go a whole day without a drink. And he said, Clay, he says, you think you can go till noon? I said, yeah. I said, go till noon and come on over and we'll make contact. So then we'd make contact. He said, well, you think you can go till knockoff? I said, yeah. Go till knockoff, and then we'll make contact. And then that contact, we'd go till the meeting at 8 o'clock that night, and then we'd go out after till midnight, get up, do the drill all over again. I wanted what you had more than the breath of life itself, and had this fear inside me that I could never get it. But I had this dilemma. You know, Shep... I was raised, and I'm so grateful, I cannot tell you the gratitude in my heart by what I choose to call the old-timers, the hardcore men of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first 6 months of sobriety this time around, I thought my name was Asshole, and I'm not exaggerating. I'd walk into a meeting, sit down, shut up, asshole. I'd raise my hand, start saying something, hey, see any amateurs in here? Everybody in here knows how to get drunk, and that's all you know how to share. Just shut up. We're talking about sobriety. When you get some, you can share that. So I'd sit there and shut up. I got called on, I'm Clay D, I'm an alcoholic, I don't know how to stay sober, and I'm going to shut up. There was none of this calling on the newcomer that's still dripping through his nose of his last puke, you know. We just didn't do it. And there was none of this sharing feelings. I won't even go into that. But I remember one time I went up to Shep, and I said, Shep, I'm having a real difficulty. You're asking me to say, Dear God, G-O-D, help me stay sober today. And at night, Dear God, G-O-D, thank you for letting me stay sober. And I feel like such a liar and such a hypocrite because I don't believe in that word. And he looked at me and he says, Why don't you try to whom it may concern? Sure. He says, God doesn't care what he's called, only that he's called. And so that night, I left that meeting, and I think I had one of my first profound spiritual awakenings. I'm driving down Cam Highway, and I'm going to go home that night, and I can't wait to say, to whom it may concern, thank you for letting me stay sober today. And I get a mile or two down the road, and the thought hit me, you know. Shep, Pete, Ed, DR, all the men had what I want. All the twinklers in that group, and God, there were a lot of them. Every one of them talked about G-O-D, as they understood G-O-D. So that night I got on my knees, and when I said thank you to G-O-D, just because in case there was one, I didn't want to tick him off. And if you're having trouble with spirituality and you're new in this program, take it from me, that does not have to be an obstacle. Because, and I'm so grateful for, you know, I believe one of the most profound statements in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous came from Ebby. You know, there's a guy named Roland Hazard who is over in Europe working with Carl Jung, trying to get sober, and the book tells a little bit about that story. And Roland's having a horrible time, and he asks Dr. Jung, so is there any hope for a guy like me? He says, the only hope there is to have a spiritual occurrence in your life. And so Roland comes back, he gets mixed up in the Oxford movement, and Ebby is supposed to go be committed. Remember Bill said, I thought it when Ebby called, he was going to be committed. I didn't know. But what happened is Roland went to court, stood up with him, and got him released in his custody. He had a spiritual awakening in the Oxford movement, and he's over in Bill's kitchen. Now, can you imagine? Here's Bill, drunker and a skunk, sucking him up. This is my fantasy anyway. Here's Ebby, giving him his best shot. You know, you've been there. You've done a 12-step on somebody who's wet. You're talking to the booze. You're not talking to the man. But it's sinking in. And because of this love and this respect that Bill had for Ebby. And in sheer desperation, you know, Ebby's trying to share this newfound God and tell him all about this experience and help him because he loves Bill. And out of sheer desperation, he says, why don't you choose your own conception of God? Do you know how powerful that is for you and me? You know, that's the only reason why I'm alive and able to stand in front of you, a free man from my disease, is because my sponsor asked me why I don't pray to whom it may concern. Because God doesn't care what he's called, only that he's called. It's a program of actions, not a program of feelings. Thank you. I feel very strongly about that. In fact, I tick a lot of people in Texas off about that. And like you wouldn't let me do, this isn't Whiners Anonymous, this isn't OB Joyfuls Anonymous, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and life happens. I was sober 9 months, and my dad took sick. My dad got sober, by the way, the year I joined the Navy. And I went home in with 9 months in my under my belt, kind of make my last aloha to Dad. It was January of 1975. In fact, my birthday is January 11th. I went home on January 10th. He was home from the hospital because he had improved. And they had a little birthday party for me, him and Mom and my sister, and he was in his chair and he sang happy birthday to me. It's a real special memory in my life. And next day he went back in the hospital. And so I was supposed to go back because I was transferring and I had to get back on January 14th. And I was supposed to fly back from Portland, Oregon to Honolulu, Hawaii at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on January 14th. And the night of January 12th, January 13th, and the morning January 14th, my dad and I just spent a lot of hours together. You know, and this thing called gratitude through forgiveness overcame me during that period of time. You see, I was able to realize in the depths of my soul that my dad hadn't done on purpose all the hurtful things he had done any more than I had. And we got to share that. At 2 o'clock that day, my dad passed away, and I was able to be there. And I didn't have to be the center of attention that I typically was. I could be there to support my sister. I could be there to support my mom. I could be there to help make family decisions. And we brought my mom back over to Hawaii, and she spent some time with us. Because of my wife was pregnant at the time with our first sober-born child, and we had picked out the name Chad Vincent if it was a boy. And because my wife had such a high regard for my dad, she said, if it's a boy, why don't we name him after your dad? And so I celebrated my first AA birthday on March 27th of 75, and then in April 20th of 75, my son, who was named after my father, Clifford Vernon Deardorff II, was born. And it's a real meaningful deal. And, you know, I mean, this is named after your dad, your first year of sobriety. I mean, you're just starting this relationship with God. And that night I came home from the hospital. I remember when he was born, he had real white hair, you know, but didn't think anything about it. I was just so elated. And I was in there in the birthing room and all that stuff, you know, that goes with it, all those blessings. And late that night, early in the morning, Linda called me, and she was distraught, and she says, you know, come to the hospital quick. There's something wrong with the baby. He's albino. So, God, I immediately start praying. I'm doing the prayers you taught me. I'm doing the Lord's Prayer. I'm doing the Serenity Prayer. I'm doing the Third Step Prayer because I'm into that action now. And I'm driving like crazy up to Tripler Army Hospital, and I come up to the light to turn left to go up the hill to the hospital. And, you know, we will intuitively know those things which used to baffle us as one of our promises. Well, I'm sitting there at that light with all this stuff going on, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, the thought hits me, Clay, you don't even know what the hell an albino is. And I didn't. And a calm overtook me, you know. I didn't know what I was going to find when I got in that hospital. All I knew was it was going to be okay. We went there, and there was a guy from that young people's group that I told you about where I got that chip. Who was an Army captain, maybe he's a major, he's a pediatrician on duty that night. The only coincidence I know is when God chooses to remain anonymous. And so we were able to process all that the first night. Other than Terry, the Army doctors in those days, they didn't know anything, especially about albinism. I can only share my experience. If you're an Army doctor, you can share your resentment later, but you have to pray for me, don't forget. But they told us if we'd wrap Cliff up like a mummy and keep him out of the sun and put him in a dark corner of the house, he may live till he's 16 or 17 years old. You know, that's tough on a young couple. And so we really... Linda was far more honest about her feelings, emotions, and anger than I was. You know, I was going to be the perfect amen. I had a year of sobriety, don't you know? And then one day I was in one of these twinklers' office. You know, you just didn't talk back to these guys. You know, I got a year under my belt, so I graduated from the word asshole to where, you know, I was Clay now, you know? And so I'm in Pete's office, and... We got to talking about Cliff and how I was doing, and I was mumbling, oh, easy does it, first things first, oh, be joyful stuff. And he says, you know, God must love you an awful lot, and that did it. That just pulled the cork off of it. And all this hurt, all this anger, all this resentment just came pouring out. And I just told him in no uncertain terms and every four-letter word I'd learned up to that point in the U.S. Navy what I thought about how much God must love me to let this happen to my father's namesake, and it was enough to deal with my dad, and yada, 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 woo, 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 boy. And I just, you know, left, right, you know. He came over, he sat down, and put his arm around me. And these guys didn't touch easy in those days. And he says to me, he says, "No, Clay, you're missing it. Just think what would have happened if that little boy would have been born with that special condition 2 years ago at the height of your alcoholism. God waited till he knew you could handle it." And tears started streaming down my eyes. I've never forgotten that. God must love me an awful lot. We transferred from there to Adak, Alaska. Linda got pregnant. This thing kept happening. We did get to use the name Chad Vincent, by the way. But we went up to Adak, Alaska. And I remember one day, we were driving down the road. Cliff's about 3 years old. Let me talk about Chad first. Chad was born with spinal meningitis. We didn't know it. He was 10 days old, went right back in the hospital. And again, it was a God thing. And so he was the only patient. He wasn't only the only baby in the hospital. He was the only patient in the hospital on that Navy base. And so with the fellowship up there and God and Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, we got through that, you know. I really related to Todd. You know, all of a sudden, we got him home, and all it was wah! You know, as soon as somebody set him down, wah! You figure every doctor, every nurse, every corpsman in that hospital carried that kid everywhere for 2 weeks. And so I got in my car, drove down to the hospital, and I mustered all of them together. I said, "Okay, I want all of you to come to my house and wean this kid off of this stuff." But one day we're driving down the road. Cliff's about 3 years old. We're just getting ready to transfer out of there. And I'll never forget this either. And you know, we're just driving along. We picked him up at the child care center. And he says out of the blue, says, "Daddy, I don't like being half blind." See, one of the deals with albinism is the macula doesn't develop in the eye. And he has 2400 vision. And that's the way it'll be the rest of his life. And so can't tell you what that did to my heart. I looked over at Linda, and she can't even talk. She's got tears streaming down her cheeks. And so I pulled off the side of the road, and I turned around and put my hand on his little knee, and I said, "Look, I said, I don't like the fact that you're half blind either. I said, but I'm an alcoholic, and you know that. And I'm up here on this Navy base in the middle of the Aleutian Islands, and I get teased a lot because Navy men don't understand that I can't drink, and they tease me because of that. And those kids in that child care center, they don't understand that you can't see the way that they do and that you look different than that. But I tell you what, I'm going to continue to work on my alcoholism if you'll continue to work on your albinism." You know, I said, "Okay." And you taught me that. You taught me that. You taught me how to be a husband. You taught me how to be a father. How we doing? There's some things that I was taught that I believe strongly in that I would like to share with you. I was taught, and it says so on page 62, that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. I was taught that alcoholism continues whether I drink or not. Drinking is but a symptom. We have to get down to causes and conditions. That's why we have to do the action. It doesn't care what we feel. It doesn't care what we think. I only care about what we do. And those are the things that we do. And what I was taught, that the thing that continues, and I believe this with my whole heart, the thing that continues whether I drink or not is selfishness and self-centeredness. And it goes on to say that it's rooted in every form of self-deception, self-pity. Self-pity is mentioned 12 times in the first 164 pages of the Big Book. That's why I really appreciate it that you didn't let me whine. That's part of my disease, and I want to be recovering. It says we must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. And this theme continues throughout the whole program. That's what I was taught. It talks about how we start our day. You know, we ask God to direct our thinking and divorce it from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking behavior, thinking. It goes on to say when we face indecision that we be given a decision, inspiration, or intuition. and to be given whatever we need to deal with whatever problems are put in front of us that day, and that we be free from self-will. You know, every day I wake up selfish and self-centered. I don't like that. It's just my reality, you know. But every day I start my day off with God, and that gives me a chance. It gives me an edge. I'm very active. I believe with my whole heart and soul. Todd and I are talking about it in sponsorship. Having a sponsor and being a sponsor. It's my lifeline. It's my lifeblood. It's the thing that keeps me fresh. It's the thing that keeps me new. And I feel very strongly because of an event that happened to me 10 years ago. I started climbing the corporate ladder. By the way, I was able to retire from the NSNS. Spent 20 years in the Navy. Retired from the Navy. And they lived happily ever after experience there. All because of sobriety. Very active. Got out. Stayed active. And then I went through a period where I'm climbing this corporate ladder. You see, I'm out from under this umbrella of the Navy. And now I can go out and be the real legend in my own mind that I always knew I could be. And so I'm going to, you know, a couple, three meetings a month, blessing you, telling you how to do it, and then, you know, going and doing my deal. I'm not sponsoring anybody or very few people. And I went into this horrible, horrible dry drunk. And I've always heard this, but I didn't have the experience of it. And experience is the most marvelous teacher I've ever had in my life. But I've always heard that the further I am away from my last drink, the closer I am to my next drunk. And I experienced that. I went rabbit-ass crazy in my mind. Now, I believe I got sober and we get sober through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. First, physically, we just quit drinking. Then mentally, you know, step two restores us to sanity, mentally and emotionally. And then step three, spiritually. I believe we relapse in that same order. I believe first thing that goes is my spiritual way of life. Then my craziness takes over, and it did. Thank you, God, I didn't have to pick up a drink. So what that experience has done for me is I'm as green as I've ever been. And boy, don't think the guys that I don't sponsor don't know it. I'm as full of passion. You know, you talk about your pockets of enthusiasm. I love what you people are doing here. I love the things that I've heard here. And I really regret that I didn't get to hear what you shared last night, but I will on the way home. And I just respect the people who do Alcoholics Anonymous and don't just go to it. Because I have to have that motivation. I have to have you go, oh, you poor baby. You know? I have to have you keep me honest because I am so selfish and so self-centered. I wake up that way every day, but I won't do it by myself. Left to my own devices, you know, I will relapse. This thing is such a gift. I got to tell you, I don't know how to describe gratitude. I never have. But my first real understanding, if there is such a thing of it, was in my very early first year of sobriety. Shep and I were golfing on this golf course one day, and I was asking him all these newcomer questions, you know, like, why Shep this? Why me that? Why me this? Why me? And I remember one question was, well, why if I have to be an alcoholic, couldn't I wait till I was old as you to quit drinking? You know, this stuff that just drives sponsors nuts, you know? And so he doesn't say anything, you know? And that should have been a clue. But he doesn't say anything. We go off three, four, five more holes. Some time goes by. All of a sudden, we're walking along this fairway. And he stops, puts his hand on my shoulder, and faces me. And it looked like fire was coming out of his mouth. He says, Clay, you stupid. And I won't tell you what he called me. He says, but when you're asking yourself all those why questions, why don't you ask yourself why you found Alcoholics Anonymous a second time, let alone at all? When somebody bigger and better than you will simply die drunk and never, ever hear of Alcoholics Anonymous. He turned around and he walked away. And I had this feeling of warm fluid running throughout my whole body all at the same time, tears streaming down my cheeks. I've never been able to get to describe what happened that day. All I know is that was my first genuine taste of gratitude. It hit me on the golf course that day that what I have, what you have, is a pure gift. It's an absolute gift of God. All I have to do is a few simple things that the recipe prescribes, and the gift is mine. And the promises are that we always occur
if I go after them, if I do what I was taught. I asked Shep one day, Shep says, I was being cool, I really, really want what you have. He said, well, that's simple. You just do what I do as long as I do it. And that's the secret of this thing. We just pass it on. I'd sit there in meetings. I'll never forget that. I'd sit there in meetings and I'd think of all this stuff that was said. And I think these guys are absolute geniuses. I'm serious. I thought, God, Shep's the smartest man on two legs. I went home and read the big book. And I said, that's where he got that. That's where he got that. That's where he got that. My wife and I celebrated 30 years of marriage this last year. She's absolutely the love of my life, the biggest single blessing of my recovery. We have three wonderful kids, and I have that boy from that first marriage. We were able, through the amends process of this program, I was able to get him back in my life. He came to live with us when he was a teenager, and we had some of the experiences that you shared, Beverly, and when he was 17 years old, we gave him a choice. He could live in a sober, recovering family, or he could go do his deal. He went and did his deal, and make a long story short, he went into treatment a year ago, and is back out again. He's given us three of the most precious grandchildren and daughters-in-law that God could ever provide him. And I just saw him last weekend. I was out at Virginia Beach at a wedding, and I hadn't heard from you for almost a year. And he said, well, I'm just so full of shame. And I said, that's crock. He said, you don't have to be there. You know that. I said, I just love you. I'm not going to go ahead and cram my sobriety down your throat. I said, I'm just blessed to have my own. I just love you. I'm your dad. I'm not your sponsor, and I want to be. But if you ever want to keep in touch with us, I want you to know shame is no excuse. We'll always love you. And so, you know, the disease just goes on. They read it last night, and it's something that's very meaningful to me, and it's something that I do. I make a dedicated effort to do it. In my morning meditations, I ask what I can do for the man who's still sick, you know. And it says in there, in a vision for you, that it's impossible for me to give away something that I don't have. And if you sponsor somebody, it's pretty hard to tell them what to do if you're not doing it. That's been my experience. So I tell you what, I love the men that I sponsor so much because I don't know what I do for them, but they do everything for me, everything. But it says to make sure that your relationship with God is right and great events will come to pass. 30 years of marriage and I love my wife and she loves me. We're best friends. You go figure that one out. Great events will come to pass. I've got three grandsons from a boy that I was estranged with who loves me. He's working on his story. He'll be here. The thing that's important for me and the thing that I feel so strongly about is the reason I don't want this to be Whiners Anonymous or OB Joyfuls Anonymous or Feelings Anonymous. The reason why I want this to be Alcoholics Anonymous, I want the same program that this Clay D walked into when that Clay D walks into it. It's so important to me. You know, we were talking... Peggy shared with us that she had heard that Dr. Paul had passed away yesterday. I didn't know him personally at all, but I can't tell you how much he's touched my heart, how much his writing, especially page 449, has meant in my life. Todd said it. God, there's another living legacy that went on. But you know, Bill went on. Dr. Bob went on. Shep someday is going to go on. We are the living legacy in this room. You and I. We have to do Alcoholics Anonymous and not just go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't want to sound like a preacher. It's just something that means everything to me. I love this program and I love this way of life more than the breath of life itself. You've taught me not only how to be a husband, you've taught me how to be a father. I have three sons and a daughter, and you know, my daughter is a good person. She's like her mother. These are the two most honest people I know in my life. They can't lie. I don't get that, but they can't lie. You know, my daughter growing up as a teenager, you come in and tell us all this stuff she did because she felt guilty. I said, who is this child? My boys are like me. We have to use, my kids are all best friends of mine. You know? See to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass. This little girl that was 1 year and 7 days old when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous is now a practicing attorney in Oklahoma City. That albino boy, I gotta tell you a story that happened to him in high school. He went out skydiving. He has taught me more about acceptance than anybody I know. You guys taught us to just, we didn't know what to do. You know, what do you do with an albino? Well, there's no school, so this is how you take care of an albino. So we just let you teach us, you know, what the program teaches. Love, patient, tolerance, treat him like you treat your other kids and see what happens. Well, he does everything in the world. I wish you could meet this kid. He's the greatest young man in the world. But he went out skydiving his senior year in high school. And just to share a little bit about the relationship that we have, how we're such good friends. And he'd come home just so exuberated, so elated. And his brother Chad and I are on the front lawn, and he's telling us this stuff. And he says, God, that was the most exciting 5 minutes of my life. I looked at Chad, and he looked at me, and you could tell we were having the same brainwave. And I said, well, thank God, your mother will know you haven't gotten laid yet. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass. That boy is living in Seattle, primarily because of its great rapid transit system. He graduated from the University of Texas and is now in an MBA program in Seattle and almost finished with that. My baby, Chad, he just graduated with his graduation last weekend at Southwest Texas. And he's getting married to a lovely young girl in October of this year. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass. You know, I didn't come to you to learn a spiritual way of life. I didn't come to you to find God. In fact, just the opposite. I didn't come to you to get sober. I certainly didn't want anything to do with that social drinking action. I came to you for one reason only. I want to get the U.S. Navy off my back. I wanted to learn how to be a heavy drinker that didn't get in trouble anymore. And that was my sole motivation. See to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass. My life is like a storybook. I don't know how to thank you. I do know I appreciate more than you know the opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. It's a privilege beyond my wildest imagination that I could ever, ever do something like this for God. It's an absolute privilege. There's a story I'd like to leave you with that I like. You may have heard it. It's been around a long time. But it touched my heart so much the first time I heard it. In fact, first time I heard it, it's the first time I heard your sponsor speak. It's a story about a little boy. He's out front with his lawn throwing a ball up and down in the air waiting for his dad to come home from work. His dad drives in the driveway and he says, hey, Dad, you want to play catch? You want to play catch tonight? And the dad has a horrible day. He says, not tonight, son. I had a horrible, horrible day. Can we do that tomorrow? Oh, yeah, Dad, no problem. Next day, Dad comes home. Little boy's out there throwing the ball up and down in the air. Said, play catch now, Dad? Tell you what, son, I had a worse day today than I had yesterday. Can we do this another time? Oh, sure, Dad, no problem. Next night, the boy is now front. The man goes in the living room. He opens up his paper, sitting in his chair, sitting there reading it, starting to relax. Here comes the boy with the ball into the living room. Pulls on his sleeve, says, Dad, hey, can we go out and play catch tonight? And so the man's feeling awful. He doesn't want to do it yet, but he's feeling guilty. But he's got the paper open, and there's one of those airline ads with a picture of the world or the globe with all these air routes on it. And so he gets this brilliant idea. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to make a puzzle for you to put together. If you can put this puzzle together, I'm going to rip all these pieces up, and you put it together the way it was, then we'll go play catch. So he opens his paper thing. He's got a lot of time to relax. All of a sudden, a minute goes by, and there's a tug on his sleeve. Daddy, I got it together. I got it together now. So the man looks down, here's the little boy with all these little pieces of torn paper in his hand, and just as perfect as it was almost before he ripped it up is a picture of the world. And the man says, how on earth did you do that? The little boy says, oh, Daddy, it was simple. And he flips it over and says, you see this picture? That's a picture of a person on the other side. I just put the person together, and the world was okay. In March 27, 1974, I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you went ahead and put this person together one day at a time, and continue to put him together, and my world is so much better than okay. I can't begin to describe it. Thank you all so very much.